My name is Rick Smalley. I'm a professor at Rice University.
Rick Smalley won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of C60, along with Bob Curl and Harold Croto.
Even if you've never heard of Richard Smalley, you might have heard of his most famous discovery, made in 1985, the Buckyball.
I managed to put the top pentagon right here on a pentagonal hole and made the first model of the C60 molecule.
One of those new molecules was the carbon nanotube, a buckyball stretched out into a cylinder. And Smalley believed that they would revolutionize everything from computers to medical devices.
About 7 years ago, I myself was diagnosed with leukemia, lymphoma.
And we wish you the speediest recovery and the best of luck in your fight against your own malignancy.
Thank you.
Rick died of cancer at the age of 62 and a half in 2005.
Let me start by sort of explaining why I'm doing this in the first place.
Some people wrote to me that they had seen Kevin Ausman talk about me on the internet and Professor Barron. And I had not seen the video, nor did I want to even go and look at it. I said, quote, "Yes, several people told me about the videos. I've not seen it, nor do I intend to listen to the false accusations. My producer gave me a very brief summary. I did not even remember Kevin, but I suppose he was a graduate student. I vaguely remember the name. He never worked in my group, so I don't recall him."
I'm a co-author on a paper with Jim Tour.
So, what were the accusations by Dr. Ausman?
Jim is an embarrassment for Rice University.
But the tenure system keeps him there.
There's the whole tenure system that's in place.
Number two, James Tour is vindictive, and it's dangerous to cross him.
Crossing him was considered by many to be a career-ending move.
Number three, concerning an educational outreach program, I pressured the NSF to accept this outreach program.
He tried to pressure the National Science Foundation to make us take that program on.
Number four, James Tour wormed his way, quote,
wormed his way onto a paper.
Number five, James Tour took over Rick Smalley's funeral.
Jim had taken control of the entire event.
To make it one of the most
disconcerting events I've ever attended.
Number six, James Tour took advantage of Rick Smalley's decline at the end of his life to do one of these three things.
Three possibilities.
A, James Tour misrepresented Rick's acceptance of the Christian message.
Jim misrepresented Rick's positions.
Or James Tour fooled himself
into believing that Rick had actually converted.
And that Rick accepted the Christian message. Or
Jim preyed on a respected colleague in decline.
And then crowed
about that conversion afterward very publicly for his own purposes.
Therefore, James Tour is either
lying
or stupid.
He's stupid.
Or reprehensible.
Or he's reprehensible.
And agreeing that Tour is possibly all three.
I have a lot of ties to Rice University. I got both my bachelor's and my PhD from the chemistry department there. I was a postdoctoral researcher there under Nobel Prize winner Richard Smalley for a year. And then I was executive director of a National Science Foundation-funded research center at Rice for 5 years.
I couldn't find Dr. Ausman's email address. Searching around, it was obvious that he works at Sparks Therapeutics.
I've recently left academia for industry, and I'm quite secure in my career, so Jim isn't really a threat to me anymore.
And so on April 11th, 2024, I called Sparks' central number, and I got connected to his office. And I left him a message, and I asked him, may we talk? And I wanted to give him my perspective on the publication in question that he says I wormed my way onto.
Wormed his way onto a paper.
And concerning the funeral that was the most disconcerting thing that he ever attended.
Was among the most disconcerting events I've ever attended.
And could he give me some specificity upon whom I was vindictive, because he just didn't say I was vindictive toward him or anyone else. And I said, if I do not hear from you in 3 days, I'll assume that you'd rather not speak. He responded by email, and he said that he's not interested in hearing about what I have to say. He said that he spoke with me for several minutes in my office about the publication in question. Again, this was over 20 years ago. But he concedes that I likely don't remember because it was just for a few minutes. He said I turned Rick Smalley's funeral into a PR stunt. And he has no personal information on how I was vindictive. But he's heard from others that I'm vindictive. Because he had nothing of his own that I was vindictive, he didn't want to go into it. And he urged me to stick to the facts in my rebuttal, because I told him I'd be coming out with a rebuttal, and he said, stick to the facts.
The issue is, for me, Jim is an embarrassment for Rice University. It's frustrating to me that he is tarnishing Rice's name by spouting his unscientific nonsense and calling it science.
If I'm an embarrassment to Rice University, nobody at Rice has ever told me that. Nobody in the administration. I see the president all the time. I see the provost all the time. And in fact, they just had a recent celebration for me because of some event, and they said very flattering things about me.
And I cannot think of anyone more fitting for that honor than you.
So if I'm an embarrassment, I'm not an embarrassment to the administration.
It was wonderful to celebrate Rice's James tour for becoming a member of the National Academy of Engineers. Jim's dedication to innovation and his profound impact on advancing nanotechnology exemplify the spirit of excellence that defines our institution.
There's the whole tenure system that's in place. But, you know, eventually bad press is may catch up.
Is it the tenure system that keeps him here? Well, I don't know. They could certainly do many things to make it difficult for me here, and they're not. They just gave me new office, new laboratories, millions and millions of dollars they spent on new laboratories. So I'm not sure that Dr. Ausman is correct on that. He said that I'm vindictive, and it's dangerous to cross me.
Jim is, or rather was, a powerful individual. Crossing him was considered by many to be a career-ending move because he would take it personally and he would use his connections vindictively. So from a career standpoint, it just wasn't smart to speak out against him.
He gave no specific examples. And then when I asked him about that, he did say in the email that he wrote to me, he had no direct experience of me being vindictive. He had just heard it from other people.
Crossing him was considered by many to be a career-ending move because he would take it personally and he would use his connections vindictively.
And that's hearsay, you know, if he publicized that hearsay, but I don't know to whom I was vindictive, but we'll ask others who've worked in that center, like Howard Schmidt, who's been gone since 2009. How hard was it to work with me? Was I a vindictive sort of person? Was I throwing my weight around in the university? Give me your thoughts on that.
That doesn't match the Jim tour that I know. I really cannot imagine where that comes from. You were really kind to me. You always did your stuff on time. You did it super thoroughly. And you comforted the students. You invited them over. You had prayer sessions with people like with me. Vindictive? You had no need to be vindictive. You know, you had a great reputation, great publications going on. I just don't get it.
And I have no influence over you or your job, so it's not like you're being scared into agreeing with me, right, Howard?
I'm terrified. No influence.
I've recently left academia for industry, and I'm quite secure in my career, so Jim isn't really a threat to me anymore.
I mean, this is silly. I didn't even know he was in academics. I don't care that he was in academics. I had no idea who he was. I didn't even remember him. Why would he do this? Well, he gives an indication as to why he came out now after these 23 years. He says, because you have already demonstrated a willingness to confidently, loudly state bald-faced lies about the primary scientific literature. He's coming out because I'm critiquing Origin of Life, and he calls them bald-faced lies. That's the exact words that a YouTuber uses. Dr. Ausman, you are a chemist. You're not a wannabe chemist. You are a chemist. How about telling me what I said that is now a bald-faced lie? You just throw those terms out there, quoting a YouTuber. What is it that I have said about Origin of Life that is a bald-faced lie? You want to get specific? Why don't you get specific?
Anything but specifics about reaction chemistry.
This is why you're coming out, because you don't like my calling out the scientific community.
Jim had this pet project, however, that he felt should constitute the entirety of our center's educational outreach activities.
He talked about an educational program. We developed a program called
Nano Kids. And so what was this, you know, miraculous thing Jim had done that should replace our entire educational portfolio? Well, Jim had drawn skeletal structures of organic compounds that looked like stick figures, you know, the crayon drawings of people with sticks for the bodies, arms, and legs. Jim then had his students synthesize those things. Jim envisioned these stick figures as being characters in videos, games, and other educational materials who would then explain science to kids. That's it. That was the entirety of his idea.
We developed a program called Nano Kids. I took 6th, 7th, and 8th grade textbooks, and I reduced each chapter to 10 bullet points. I hired people to write rock, pop, and rap music for Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution, and they worked through these things, and the teachers and the students loved it.
Now that's the color of the solution that we've been looking for. Good job.
Well, that program, in its first year, had 40,000 teacher downloads in the state of Texas. That program had over 1 million student downloads in the state of Texas. I then turned it over to Rice University Education Department, and they took it and they ran it for a few years. And then after that, I'm not sure what happened to it.
And purportedly, he tried to pressure the National Science Foundation, our funding agency, to make us take that program on. It's called Nano Kids.
And then he says that I pressured the NSF to accept this outreach program. I never pressured the NSF. I never talked to the NSF on Rick's behalf on his grant. I appeared once to the NSF long before this became an issue to try to get funding for it myself. I never pressured anyone at the NSF to put this on Rick's grant. So I'm not sure what he's talking about. I'm sorry he feels that I did that. Let's get to this publication. It's called Reversible Water Solubilization of Single-Wall Carbon Nanotubes by Polymer Wrapping. He said that I
wormed his way onto a paper without ever having actually contributed anything meaningful to it.
I had no contribution to it, but they were politically forced to do this. Now, let me tell you something. Rick Smalley was not politically forced to do anything. Rick Smalley was king of the hill here, for sure. I never spoke to Rick Smalley about this paper, as far as I know. Kevin Ausman says he talked about it with me in my office for a few minutes. I don't remember. And he concedes it wasn't a dramatic conversation, so I might not remember. I do remember speaking with the second author here, Peter Boole. I haven't spoken to Peter in probably more than 15 years. I sent him an email that had the link to Dr. Ausman's accusations, and he could listen to those, and then he responded to them. And I want you to see that there are two polymers that are used here. One is polyvinyl pyrrolidone, PVP, and the other is polystyrene sulfonate. And as I had recalled, I had suggested the polystyrene sulfonate, which was half of this paper. And Peter Boole had attended my group meetings, and I wasn't sure of this until I had spoken with Peter Boole. Michael O'Connell was the other person that attended my group meeting. Michael O'Connell unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago, so we're not able to speak with him. But Peter Boole was a major player on this paper right alongside of Michael. These two were doing the bulk of the work. Because of his traveling, he couldn't do an interview, but here's what he writes. Regarding the CPL paper from 2001, on which you are a co-author, I requested that your name be added to the author list because you had provided the initial suggestion to use polystyrene sulfonate as a dispersant for carbon nanotubes. I recall that you had suggested this polymer shortly after your arrival to Rice University from South Carolina. This polymer and its use as a dispersant are featured heavily in the paper, and so your contribution warranted co-authorship. I regret that you were not able to review the paper prior to its publication. Well, Peter, my not reviewing the paper wasn't your fault. Dr. Ausman said he was the one who had submitted the paper.
I'm the person that wrote this paper.
It was his job to have asked me. It was his job to confirm this because he, upon submission, is confirming that all the authors had read and approved the manuscript.
When I was working on the author list, I was told to include Jim because it was politically the right thing to do.
He obviously violated that because he had never showed it to me, and that's why my name is listed as Jim Tour. I have never published under the name Jim Tour. If you look at my hundreds and hundreds of publications that are posted on my website, not one of them is labeled Jim Tour except this one. Had I ever seen this, I would have said that that's not my name. Go to James M. Tour. That's how I publish. Once in a while, we'll publish under J. M. Tour when the editor requests that we just use first and middle initials. But what's telling here is that, you know, I came to Rice University in 1999. I taught for 11 years at the University of South Carolina, And then I came in 99, and that's when I met Peter. He was already in Dr. Smalley's group. And he's saying it was from that time, 2 years before the publication, that I had suggested the polystyrene sulfonate. And then mind you, from 99 through 2001 and continuing on, Peter Buhl attended my group meetings as if he was my student, in the sense that he was presenting his work and I was commenting and critiquing upon his work as I would with my own students. And he didn't just write this concurring with what I said about the situation, not with what Dr. Ausman said. You clearly see Dr. Ausman is incorrect here.
And yet he contributed nothing to that paper.
He said something further. I haven't observed any vindictiveness from you to anyone. I find that you are more inspirational and positively motivated than to engage in that way. You welcomed me, along with other colleagues of mine, to your team meetings. I have appreciated my interactions with you at Rice University, and then later when I was at NASA. I've enjoyed having had the opportunity to work with you.
Well, it was ridiculous enough to us to think that this sheet would curve around all by itself.
Now, ordinary diamond doesn't have
a... You know, Rick was a famous scientist and is, and he's amazing, but he also had a private life. We were dating, and it was Christmas Eve, so I suggested we go to a Christmas Eve service, and I think it was St. Paul Methodist. It was over by Rice, and so we had dinner. We went there. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but he was deeply touched at that service. Afterwards, he asked me if I would go to church with him like every Sunday, and we did. And he called it our little Christian adventure.
And Debbie, can I just interrupt you? One thing I just want to ask. He was not on his deathbed, suffering with cancer at this point. He was in remission, was he not?
No, we were having a lot of fun. No, he didn't come and, you know, try to form a relationship with me because he thought he wasn't going to live. And we had plans.
What bothers me so much and makes me just livid is that Rick's last year or two were hijacked by Jim. And in the weakness of being close to his inevitable death, Rick didn't sufficiently safeguard his legacy against being appropriated by someone who was so obviously agenda-driven rather than data-driven, as Rick was himself.
But I will also say, if people were saying, oh, well, he wasn't well.
His last year or so, and especially his last few months, showed a decline in his mental acuity.
Okay, let's put it this way. Within the last few months of his life, we went to New York. We went on a National Geographic photo shoot in the mud flats in Utah. We went to Yellowstone. He was up and mobile and functioning well.
And even while he was in the hospital room, he was directing research. We used to go over there. A lot of the students would go over there to have meetings with him. And here's a man fighting cancer. And he really sat there with each and every student when they would come in and then and just tell them exactly what he wanted to do. And he would direct, and then you would have to update him because he would check his email frequently.
Yeah, thank goodness for the people that, as it turned out, were lined up to step in and help us when we asked for it. And in this case, Jim, you were called to be part of that walk.
During that period, Jim dug his claws into Rick mercilessly.
You did not coerce him in any way. You were asked every step of the way, you know. Of course, you were happy to do it. It's not like you weren't busy, though. And he so appreciated it.
Jim preyed on a respected colleague in decline.
I would never have let anything happen to him if he would have come to the point where he was a poor little lamb that couldn't defend himself. But he never actually got to that point.
He never got there.
No, he never got there. Yeah. He was so brave and wonderful and courageous. And I think what he was finding was that he was getting from what he called our little Christian adventure, he was finding that peace that he'd been looking for and that joy. And so he entered into that adventure, I guess, the way a scientist would. And he said, there is a scientist at the university, well-respected, you know, he's very good and he's a believer. And I'm going to start talking to him.
I just appreciate your saying that he approached me with the questions he asked me. Let me just tell you that the first time Richard Smalley asked me about my faith, I wasn't trying to share with him. He and I were on a flight to California. We were going to visit the CEO of Intel. Rick asked me about my faith on that flight. We were sitting in first class together. He turned to me, he said, "Jim, do you really believe all that stuff in the Bible?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I do. Why do you ask?" He said, "Good. Somebody with a brain that I can talk to." And so I shared with him. And after about an hour of sharing with him, he said, "Wow, you know why you spoke with me?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Do you know why you talked to me about this?" I said, "Well, you asked me." He said, "No, you spoke to me because you're really a Jew. Now, if you'd have been a Baptist, you would have just said, 'Well, that's the way it is.' But you took the time to explain it to me." I had in my briefcase a copy of God in the Dock by C.S. Lewis, and I handed it to Rick that day. Just a quick reminder, this organization is run totally by volunteers, but we do have to pay for the production work. If you could help us out by going to give.jesusandscience.org, we'd appreciate it, or you can click in the description box below. If you can't give, we certainly understand, but please just give us a thumbs up and click subscribe. Thank you. We went to the hotel. He went to his room. I went to my room. We were staying in the same hotel. He came down in the morning. I met him in the lobby. He gave me the book back. He says, "I read the book." He says, "This guy was quite a thinker," because I had told him he's probably one of the deepest Christian thinkers of the 20th century, and Rick agreed. And so we went, we gave our presentations, he on nanotubes, me, I on molecular electronics, and then Rick had to fly somewhere else, and I flew back to Houston. And I went out, and I bought a copy of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, bought a copy of The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, and a copy of Creator and the Cosmos by Hugh Ross. And I left all three of those books on Rick's desk, went to his office, left them on his desk. His secretary let me in, left them on his desk as a present to him. Well, when he got back, he read all three books, and he then told me about his reading of those three books. He said, "Mere Christianity," he says, "it was a good book, but I was left hanging at the end." He says, "The Case for Christ was interesting book, but he felt it was a little elementary." He loved Creator and the Cosmos by Hugh Ross. He says, "That book was great." I said, "Would you like to meet Hugh?"
"Whether you are a religious person or not, I invite you to put your worldview to the test."
One day I was at work and I got a phone call. And he said, "Some guy named Hugh Ross is going to come talk to me." You know, because he had these questions and Hugh Ross apparently had the answers. And I knew who Hugh Ross was. And so I said, "Wow, I wish I could be a fly on the wall." And when that happens, he goes, "You don't have to be a fly on the wall. You're welcome to come."
I also set up a meeting between Rick and Hugh and myself and Debbie Smalley, Rick's wife, in my office. And Rick peppered Hugh Ross for well over an hour with questions, one question after another, after another.
I was patiently waiting for Rick to quit asking all of his questions so I could ask two of the what I considered the most difficult questions, but Hugh Ross handled them like a, you know, like they were nothing. So
he had a lot of questions about the early chapters of Genesis, so I answered those questions. We got into the book of Job and other passages, and then he attended a lecture I was giving to the students and faculty.
And I remember Rick Smalley and I were sitting like in the third row back. It was in a big amphitheater at Rice. And he kept leaning over to my wife and he said, "This is the smartest guy I've ever seen," speaking of Hugh Ross.
And I could see him sitting in the second row. And I was giving a talk on why the universe is structured the way it is. And he was taking furious notes in that second row, the only one in the auditorium that was literally writing down every word I was saying. He thanked me briefly after the talk, and I got an email from him about 2 weeks later. And he said, "I'm not a believer, but I decided to put your beliefs to the test." And that's when he began to read our books. And every time he read one of our books, I would get an email from him telling me what the book meant to him.
At Second Baptist, you were there once and you gave a sermon. And he really latched onto the part about getting up early and studying, you know, the Bible.
The fundamental thing that I always put forward to you is this: time in the Word of God. If you will set your time to wake up in the morning and spend time in the Scriptures, time with God, your life will change.
And even on our honeymoon, by the way, which, yeah, anyway, he was doing that, but he had a finished off roof with pigeons, you know, it's like, you can go sit up there. That's where he used to go, in his bathrobe, with a Bible. He used to go up there and read the Word. If you can picture Rick saying that.
I wish that I was able to be at the award ceremony. Probably by the time that award ceremony is going on, I will be behind closed doors at MD Anderson in the midst of a bone marrow transplant. So that's why we're taping this in advance.
He didn't know when he made that decision to go on his little Christian adventure with me that he was going to die. But he didn't know that. But he certainly was glad that he chose that. Like, there was not a moment, there was not a day that he was not happy that he chose to accept the invitation. But Shereen, your wife, God bless her, you know, she came over and Rick liked for us to pray for him. But he would be so touched, it'd bring him to tears because he just felt that presence of God on the when we prayed. And that's what he was looking for. But how wonderful that the person that could answer and guide him and help him with books and resources was right next door, and which was you. And so, yeah, we are forever grateful for that.
He dug his claws into Rick by things like private conversations at the hospital during Rick's chemotherapy treatments. After Rick was dead, those conversations were described very publicly by Jim as a conversion to Christianity.
I did visit him when he would go in for his outpatient infusions sometimes at MD Anderson when he had a recurrence. Most of those times he was talking about science, and he was talking about using carbon nanotubes even to treat cancers and things like that.
And one of the areas of applications of these tubes, and for that matter the balls, is in the diagnosis and treatment of diseases in general, and cancer in particular.
That was what initiated me to begin to explore this with one of the members in his group, and then I took it over after Rick's death, started working with people at MD Anderson on this thing.
Richard Smalley was a chemist whose last name turned out to be quite appropriate. That's because Smalley was a force in developing the field of nanotechnology. Smalley died on Friday. NPR's Nell Boyce has this report on the Nobel Prize winner.
Rick's funeral was among the most disconcerting events I've ever attended. Jim had taken control of the entire event, and of all people, Hugh Ross was, the best I can describe it is as the keynote speaker, as though it were some kind of faux scientific conference.
Then when he passed, his wife invited me to speak at his funeral. And so one of the pastors at Second Baptist spoke, Jim Tour spoke, and I spoke.
As far as Rick's funeral, just being such an alarming and painful thing for Dr. Ausman,
was among the most disconcerting events I've ever attended.
Quite frankly, I thought the funeral was beautiful and wonderful and perfect.
I invite you to listen to that funeral. It's 45 minutes. You can listen to it like on 2x speed if you want.
Jim had taken control of the entire event.
Of course you did not take it over. Of course you were doing us a favor by accepting it. And I had no idea that you would be persecuted for it.
There's nothing alarming there. I didn't organize the funeral. I didn't arrange the funeral. I didn't organize the speakers. Debbie Smalley asked me if I could get Hugh Ross, and I said, I can ask Hugh. And then she wanted her pastor, Ben Young, to speak. And you can go back and you can listen. There were some professional singers there that were part of the worship team at Second Baptist. That's a very large church. We're talking like 50,000 plus people. And so they have really talented folks there. And they sang a few songs, and then I got up and I read a statement.
On behalf of Debbie Smalley and the Smalley family, I want to thank you for your kindness and support.
I read a statement that was written by Debbie Smalley, which acknowledged Debbie and the brothers and the sisters and the children, and I read all the names.
And then I read about six verses from the Bible that were Rick's favorite verses.
Be strong and very courageous.
I didn't choose them. I didn't know what his favorite verses were. Debbie knew. She gave me that passage to read out of Joshua chapter 1. So I read those verses, and then the only ad-lib thing that I did is I prayed for about 1 minute.
In the name of Jesus, amen.
And then I introduced Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross spoke for 10 minutes.
Well, as Jim has pointed out, I'm here because these men behind me invited me 16 months ago to ask if I'd be willing to fly to Houston to answer a Nobel laureate's questions about science and the Christian faith.
Ross gave a speech that lauded Rick's conversion, seeing the light, as it were.
I'm really mystified why anybody would complain about Christian comments at a funeral. I mean, this is a personal, private, family matter. You know, the topics for funerals are those of eternity, right? What more could you expect? I mean, there was a separate memorial service for Rick and Rice to handle the scientific side of it. And, you know, I remember Lou Bruce spoke, and he described Rick as the greatest experimentalist of our generation.
I thought he did a terrific job. If you didn't like what he said, okay, well, it's not your funeral. Then Pastor Ben Young spoke for 21 minutes, and then there was a song, and it was over. So this was not so alarming of your funeral, not at all. It is a huge exaggeration, in my opinion. But this is why I'm presenting this, so that you, the listeners, can go and to see, are these grievances of Dr. Ausman about me and my actions, are these valid? Just use the funeral as a touch point to see. You can listen to the funeral. I don't think he knew that I had a recording of the funeral. Now, I want you to see, this is a slide that I've taken from Kevin Ausman's Facebook page. And Kevin Ausman says on his Facebook page here, he says, I'm an atheist, ask me anything. So he's an atheist, ask him anything. And that's fine. I'm a Christian, you know, so I invite people to come and talk to me. I certainly do that. And if you don't know the Lord, if you don't believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, you're the one that I really want to share with. Here's an important question. Why would anyone believe that a man named Jesus died and rose from the dead? If you don't believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send an email to tour@drjamestour.org and we'll set up a meeting and I will tell you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so I invite the people that do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ to come and to speak to me. He's an atheist. He invites them to speak with him. That's good. Good for Kevin Ausman. He does that. That's good. Why should he mind? Why, Kevin, would you mind that I invite people to talk with me? You invite people to talk with you. Here's another page from one of your blogs, you Convert the Atheist. So you ask people to come to you to try to convert you. That's fine. So why do you mind when people come to me and ask me about my faith? So in summary, what are the accusations by Dr. Ausman? He says James Tour is an embarrassment for Rice University, but the tenure system keeps him there. If I'm an embarrassment to the university, why would they give me all new offices? I think it's the biggest office in this building. And all new laboratories built to my specifications. We're talking millions of dollars. Why would the president be putting up on X just recently when I won some national award? I don't know where Dr. Ausman is getting his information on this. Sounds like something a YouTuber might say. The second accusation, James Tour is vindictive and it's dangerous to cross him.
Crossing him was considered by many to be a career-ending move.
Well, Howard Schmidt, who was the executive director of the Carbon Nanotechnology Laboratory and then Dr. Smalley's executive director, he has very different words to say about that. And now Peter Buhl had very different words to say about that. Dr. Ausman came with no specific accusations, couldn't give a single example of it. He said, I
pressured the National Science Foundation
to accept this NSF outreach program. I don't know how you can pressure people in a funding agency. I wish I knew. Can I pressure people to get them to fund my group? I don't have any funding at this moment from the National Science Foundation. None. Zero. So much for my pressure. I don't think it's possible to pressure people. You had an academic career, Dr. Ausman.
Hi there. Welcome to Chem 112, General Chemistry 2.
I don't know how long you were a professor, 10 years, 15 years? How did that go, trying to pressure people in the funding agencies to get funding? Did you get a lot of funding that way? And it turns out that that educational program, which you belittle as being little stick figures.
It was like stick figures. That was the entirety of his idea.
That turned out to be the biggest program in the state and maybe the fastest growing in the country scientific program for middle school. You were a professor for many years. How were your outreach programs? Tell us about that. Accusation number four, James Tour
wormed his way onto a paper.
Well, you've heard my testimony on that, and you've heard Peter Bull's resonates exactly with my recollection on that. James Tour took over Rick Smalley's funeral to make it into one of the most
disconcerting events I've ever attended.
Well, you can listen to that funeral ceremony, but then you also saw Debbie Smalley's testimony.
Quite frankly, I thought the funeral was beautiful and wonderful and perfect.
And Howard Schmidt couldn't understand where an accusation like this would come from. And of a 45-minute funeral, I spoke for 4 minutes. James Tour took advantage of Rick Smalley's decline at the end of his life to do one of three things.
Three possibilities.
He says James Tour misrepresented Rick's acceptance of the Christian message.
Jim misrepresented Rick's positions.
Did Debbie Smalley misrepresent what happened in that church service? Or James Tour
fooled himself into believing that Rick had actually converted?
Really? How about Debbie Smalley? How about his wife? Was she fooled too?
He had a new, deeper faith in God.
How about Howard Schmidt? Was he fooled as well?
I've heard it expressed that, you know, doubts that Rick was a Christian. He told me he was.
Says James Tour
preyed on a respected colleague in decline.
And then crowed
about that conversion afterward very publicly for his own purposes.
No, you heard Debbie's testimony. She said he was himself right up until the end as far as his mind was gone.
He was turned on, full of hope, joy, and love to the very last moment.
His mind was good right up till the end. So I'm not accusing Dr. Ausman of lying, of being stupid or reprehensible. I just think he's forgetful. That's it. Well, why would I suggest that he's forgetful? Because he himself has said that he has a poor memory.
Memory works differently in different people. I am more intelligent and more educated than most people, and yet I have a horrible memory for details. Spelling? Memorization, and I suck at it. If I am introduced to you, I guarantee that I will forget your name. I don't remember the birthdays of the people closest to me. I don't remember what year I got divorced, somewhere between 4 and 8 years ago, I think.
So I'm glad you consider yourself more intelligent than most people, Dr. Ausman. So that's why I attribute all of this, all of these false accusations, to Dr. Ausman's horrible memory. Dr. Ausman, with his self-diagnosed poor memory, misrepresented events from 20 years ago. As a result of his poor memory, it led to inaccurate descriptions of events, descriptions upon which others could not concur. Dr. Howard Schmidt couldn't concur with him. Debbie Smalley couldn't concur with him. Dr. Peter Buhl could not concur with the things that he was saying. In every case, Dr. Ausman was inaccurate, further resulting in his labeling of me as lying, stupid, and reprehensible, preying upon the sick, worming my way onto papers, and vindictively threatening the careers of peers, all because of his horrible memory. I have nothing to say in return upon Dr. Ausman's character. He just has a self-proclaimed poor memory. That's what he said of himself. Dr. Ausman wrote, quote, "If you stick to the facts and your own perspective, I won't feel the need to respond, allowing the viewer to listen to what I said and to what you said and make up their own mind," unquote. So, Dr. Ausman, there you have it. There's what I said. And now the viewer can make a judgment. Let me give you a quote from the book of Proverbs, chapter 18, verse 17. It says, "The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him." Okay, so I've examined Dr. Ausman with witnesses. Witnesses that I have no control over. I intentionally got people that have nothing to do with Rice University that were disassociated from this university for more than 15 years. And now the viewer can make the judgment. I'd like to close reading a few lines from Psalm 109, verses 1 through 3. O God of my praise, do not be silent, for they have opened the wicked and deceitful mouth against me. They have spoken against me with a lying tongue. They have also surrounded me with words of hatred and fought against me without cause. Thank you for listening. We're next going to look at Professor Andrew Barron and his accusations against me, and we'll take them one by one, and I hope to give you a different perspective. Did you get to see the video where the accusations came against me?
Yeah, I had to pray over my phone after that. It was very disturbing, yeah. And this is what I think. I think that, to tell you the honest truth, I don't believe that I can help your accusers change their... I don't believe I can help your accusers at all, but God can, and I pray for them. I know you're protected, and I know that there's probably armies of angels over you, and that God will turn this to your good, but I am concerned about the spirit behind some of the things said, and I really feel for some of the people that knew, or a couple of the people that knew Rick and didn't understand that the end of his life was as wonderful as it was, and had either bought into or imagined some horrific ending. And so what I would say to them is, be at peace. Everyone gets to make choices, and I can't make any choices for you, but be at peace.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to give to help out with these podcasts, you can go to jesusandscience.org. All donations are tax deductible. We have no employees in this organization. All the money just goes for the contract work on the production. Thanks so much.